Hi, welcome to Politics and Science. I'm your host, John Barkhausen. This week, we turn back to retired presenter for the BBC, Anna Breeze, and her channel, Anna Breeze Media. And she's interviewing Dr. Michael Yaden. And he has some impressive credentials to talk about respiratory viruses and diseases. He's an allergy and respiratory therapeutic area expert. He's worked for 23 years in the pharmaceutical industry. He's trained as a biochemist and pharmacologist, obtaining his PhD from the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom in 1988. And I believe he's worked for Pfizer for 9 years. He was in charge of research for Pfizer in Europe, research and development of drugs. And he developed all sorts of medicines with them. He's very disturbed by what's going on in Europe and around the world in regards to the science and COVID-19. So this is a very interesting interview. I hope you enjoy it. It's followed by another presenter. Anna Breeze was a former presenter in English News, and another presenter is Emma Kenny. And she has been working with children's charities, and she has an impassioned plea for looking out for the well-being of all of our children. This is all referencing the response to the coronavirus and public policy in England, but it has a direct link to everything that's going on here in the United States and around the world. So it's all relevant, and what's happening there is probably going to be happening here, if it isn't already, very soon. All right, well, let's get started, and Anna Breeze will introduce Dr. Michael Yaden.
So, everyone, it is Dr. Mike Yaden I'm going to be speaking to. It's the 29th of October, 2020. Now, Mike is semi-retired. He's 60 years old, and he's currently in France. He has a first-class degree in biochemistry, toxicology, and pharmacology. He also has a PhD in pharmacology. He was at Pfizer for 17 years, left in 2011 as the chief scientific officer and vice president for allergy and respiratory research. Really good to speak to you. We've been chatting a little bit over the last few weeks. I know you're in France at the moment. It's a difficult time. What I want to say to you first, to make this current, we're going to be talking about the media. We're going to be talking about where you've been able to share your concerns so far, your view is of the media, what your view is of the government, what your view is of somebody called Sir Patrick Vallance, who you used to work with, and also what you think about in terms of the British public and where we're going in terms of democracy and your concerns for the future and where we're at the moment with regard to lockdown, because you're obviously in France. It's just been announced this lockdown situation. So first of all, I just want to ask you, challenge you here. I've just looked at the daily death count. So over the last few days, 151, 102, 367, 310. It is going up, and it does look like it's doubling right at the end of the curve. So is it right that these measures are taking place right now with all these lockdowns and potentially a national lockdown?
It is my opinion that the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic in the UK, finished at the end of summer. I believe that because nearly a third of the people had prior immunity from exposed, because they've been exposed to related viruses. That's how the immune system works. About another third have been exposed during the pandemic and are now immune. And if I'm right, there are too few people left in the country to support the kind of outbreak that the government tells us is occurring. So, couple of problems there. How can that be? Well, I believe that the industrialized molecular biological technique called PCR, so it's never been used on the scale it's being used. I think it is currently throwing up an enormous number of false positives. That is, when the test is positive, even though there wasn't virus in the sample. And what that does is, of course, frighten everybody. Because we've tested now, I think, about 30 million people in the UK, we're pushing towards half the population. A large number of those tests have been recently. And as you know, the definition of a coronavirus death is someone who dies for any reason within 28 days of a positive test. So what I'm telling you, Anna, is that People are dying, they always do, I'm afraid, about 1,700 a day in the UK, or 620,000 a year. They are dying. I don't believe that they're dying of coronavirus anymore. I think they're dying of other respiratory viruses or other non-respiratory causes. So I guess I'm calling out the statistics and even the claim that there is an ongoing pandemic as false. And you might say that's crazy, everybody knows that's wrong. I would point anyone listening to this who wants to check to go to any database that talks about total mortality. That is a body count over time. And when you do that, you will see that the number of deaths on average every day in the UK is absolutely bang on normal for the time of year. Not at all higher. In fact, anything slightly lower, and the respiratory death numbers are lower than over the last 5 years at late October. So the important point to note is there are no excess deaths, no excess respiratory deaths. And so if you accept that, and if anyone listening checks it, they must know that the rest of what I'm telling you is true, because you can't have a lethal pandemic stalking the land and not have excess deaths.
Well, absolutely. But I have to say, you know, my audience, I like to keep things really simple and communicate in simple terms. You know, we're none of us are experts on these matters, on viruses and on PCR tests and epidemiology. Yes. We just don't really understand. We just want to know what to do for the safety of our family. And we want to feel confident that the future is going to be a positive one, where we can get on with our lives and experience joy again, and not think the government has stolen a year of my life. And, you know, there's real concerns with censorship. Mm-hmm. For me as a journalist, censorship and surveillance, and massive concerns when, you know, the Great Barrington Declaration, when those professors in epidemiology came out from Stanford and Oxford and Harvard, and how they smeared, how the Guardian tried to smear them. And we're not even getting access to truthful information at the moment. And I'm trying to interview people like yourself, and I'm calling them courageous and compassionate professionals trying to get a message out there. I'm afraid angry, shocked and disappointed by former colleagues that I work with at Sky News, ITV, BBC. There's so many of them. Some of them are communicating with me. Some of them are trying to reform from within. There's not enough whistleblowers coming out, as far as I'm concerned. So you have these brave scientists and doctors. You know, I've spoken to some of them on the channel, but I'm not seeing that in the media world so much. These BBC editors coming and saying, yes, I have been told specifically, I've got a Guardian reporter, for example, I have to smear the Great Barrington Declaration. I'm not seeing media whistleblowers. So people like you are so, so important. And you even have a campaign on Twitter called I Am Yeadon. Uh-huh. They believe if you did a live press conference with some politicians, that would win the public over.
Well, let me just say, what I'm doing today, Anna, is I'm doing it because I think it's very important. The information I have gleaned just by looking at public data, there's nothing special about what I'm doing given my background. It's easy for me to see that there aren't excess deaths. It's easy for me to know with a level of certainty that I hold very strongly that when you've been infected and survived after a respiratory virus, you are immune. I'm sick of people saying, well, your antibodies are falling away. First, antibodies are simply not that important in immune defense against viruses. It's T cells. I was taught this as an undergraduate 35 years ago. So was Patrick Vallance. So when people say they're worried about antibodies and immunity fading, they're either mistaken, if they're perhaps journalists, that's the brief they've been given. If they are expert scientists, I'm afraid they're looking you in the eye and lying to you, because what I've just said is true. We're confident once you've survived, you are immune, unless the virus is one that destroys the immune system.
The BBC didn't say that. The BBC didn't say that. Two nights ago, I was watching it. They said you could get it again. Did you could get it again? But then Professor Sneetra Gupta, it's like SARS-CoV, so the first SARS-CoV in 2003, that never came back, I believe. There's immunity from that, which is 17 years. So why are the BBC saying that we might get it again?
Someone must be giving them a script. So, Anna, before I go any further, just to check if people came in at this clip, say yes or no to this question. Do you believe that media in UK are being censored related to SARS-CoV-2? Are the media in our country being censored? That is, are they
more and more people are coming around to thinking that way? More and more people are coming around to thinking that way. Absolutely. From, you know, from anyone like myself, independent journalists now, the views mm-hmm. and the following, you know, I really like Freddie Sayers from Unheard, and he's interviewed yes. about herd immunity. The difference mm-hmm. with Freddie Sayers is he's not as emotional as me, and it's very difficult because I'm congruent. I am very concerned about my children. I'm very concerned about suicide, about elderly in care who are not seeing their relatives and dying alone. And I keep hearing these stories, and I know you feel the same, Mike. And
I do.
These interviews are emotionally draining, which is why I don't want to get you to keep repeating the same thing. I have a very different angle with these interviews that I put on my channel. So you've done a very long interview with Professor James Dellingpole. Please, guys, go and listen to that. You've also done an interview with Talk Radio, and I just don't. I know you are probably in a similar position, say, to Professor Martin Kaldor from Harvard, where he wanted to speak out. So I saw mm-hmm. he was on Radio Northern yeah. Ireland. Then he ended up being on a YouTube channel, and then he yeah. was smeared for talking to a particular YouTube channel. This is yeah. so wrong. Journalists don't allow yes. this to happen. So you've had conversations with the BBC, I know. We need to get you on the BBC, don't we, Mike? Would that help?
That could help, although I have to say, it's not my job to do this. I have provided in writing, on podcast long form, and in video now, all the evidence anyone would need to determine that the government and states, for whatever reasons, are, I'm afraid I'll be direct, they are lying to you. The pandemic is not raging. If it was raging, there would be excess deaths. There are not excess deaths. Let me tell you something else I learned just before this call, because I knew you were going to ask me about the recent upturn in deaths. There is slight excess death. So I called a good friend of mine who's a pathologist. That person told me that there is a slight increase in deaths. But let me just characterize what she said, that they're not mostly very old people, which are generally the people who die with COVID. They are male and female equally, whereas COVID kills slightly more men than women. So much younger, and then male and female ratio is wrong for COVID. But then here's the thing that really hurts, and not respiratory deaths. Mostly dying of ischemic heart disease and stroke and untreated cancers. In other words, the kind of things that might happen to your neighbours and yourself and your family if your government deprived you of access to the healthcare system for the most part of 6 months. So that's my answer to the excess deaths that aren't coronavirus excess deaths. There are not. I think the pandemic is essentially finished and it might be complete. There are not generally an increase in deaths, and the ones that have been recorded in recent days are definitely not characteristic of the deaths of COVID. They may have that diagnosis. I think that's a false positive test. But just listen to the actual description of these poor people who recently died. They're between 45 and 65, men and women equally, not respiratory deaths, strokes, cancers, heart attacks.
So these figures I just quoted then, they've gone up from sort of the 50 to 100 to 300 in the last few days. You're saying they've been falsely, they have died with, not of.
No. Let's be clear. I was talking just then about overall mortality. Roughly 1,700 people die a day. If we had a lethal pandemic sweeping through the land, you would expect several hundred a day extra. We're not seeing any of that. There is no increase at all. So, but the recently reported coronavirus deaths, as you say, going from 20, 50, 100, 300, I'm saying those people have genuinely died. No one is faking death certificates. All I am saying is that they have done so many tests on so many people, including on all hospital admissions get tested regularly. There's a false positive rate. If you're tested repeatedly, the odds become greater and greater that you will get a positive test. The longer you stay in hospital, the more likely you are to die. Obviously, you would be released if you were well and improving. So people who stay a long time, so-called long-stay patients, are both more likely to die statistically and much more likely to be tested so often that they'll have a false positive test. That is what I think is happening. And it's a convenience for whoever is playing some macabre game, because I don't think it's an error anymore. But this industrial scale PCR test, 300,000 or so tests a day, They don't release even the basic information about it, like the false positive rate. It's unbelievable that public health people who do know better, I've spoken to some people in it, and they're embarrassed that they're not even being allowed to characterize and publish the information you would need to know to work out how useful the test is. That's not being done. It's full steam ahead. And that's what I think is happening. They are real deaths, but they're not COVID.
Absolutely. And I did an interview with the former BBC presenter, Sue Cook, who was on Crime Watch and Children in Need, very well respected. And she's at this stage, I've got to do a documentary. She wants to do a documentary on the testing. She thinks if we get that out there, people will start to see what you're describing. I'm kind of further on from that now. And I'm where you just said it's not an error anymore. I'm further on now. I'm starting to think something very, very, very sinister going on. And I've mentioned this before. I wanted to mention to you, you work with Sir Patrick Vallance. Now, yes. BBC did a Freedom of Information request and saw some emails right from back at the beginning of all of this in March. Yes. On March the 13th, COVID-19 began to sweep across the UK. Sir Patrick Vallance told BBC Radio 4 and Sky News that the country would need to build up some degree of herd immunity. Then 500 academics published a joint letter saying, you can't do this. You're going to allow all these unnecessary deaths. This is the wrong approach. You've got to go lockdown. So, you work with Sir Patrick Vallance. You can be very critical of them. But were they put under so much pressure? You're killers, basically. You have to lockdown, that they changed direction.
So I didn't, until recently, none of us knew about this email exchange between Professor Whitty and Sir Patrick Vallance. I've read it. Now it's been leaked or released, as you say, Freedom of Information. It looked to me like two earnest people, a medic and a doctor with a PhD, an earnest exchange about what would be best given there is this infection that's going to arrive or was already here. How should we best handle this? So I thought that was an honourable exchange at the time. I would tell you, that at the same time in Sweden, that Anders Tegnell, who is the state epidemiologist, was speaking to his mentor, Professor Johan Giesecke, who was previously the Sweden's national epidemiologist and is now a senior figure in the WHO. They had similar email exchanges, phone calls about how are we best going to do this. And their conclusion was that you can't hide from respiratory viruses. Some people say they're slippery customers. They will spread around the country whatever you do. This idea of hiding from is it's an invention this year. I feel quite sorry that people think that, quote, locking down will allow us to escape. It's not like the weather. When you come out again, it's gone, like escaping a hurricane. That would be, I think that's what people feel the analogy is, and in which case I understand why they would go for it. It's not like the weather. It's when you come out again, it's exactly where you were before. And furthermore, the kind of things we shut down when we lock down, the ability right now of family members to speak, to meet each other at all, inside their home or outside their home, these things are not the most important places for transmission. High-speed transmission occurred early in the year in hospitals, as it always does. It's not their fault. The reason hospitals become a major exchange center for diseases is because it's full of ill people. So they have infection control specialists, but it's really, really hard. People coming in and out. And we have over 1 million people in the UK work for the health service in one way or another. So that and old people's homes, I believe, maybe also supermarkets and all the supply chain, I believe that was sufficient to allow the virus to sweep through the country, ignoring completely all the sacrifices and, quotes, measures that we made. And the evidence for that is that countries that didn't lock down, like Sweden, just little precautions, had exactly the same profile of deaths, this sort of Gompertz curve shape that others can look at in my podcast. There's no difference in the shape and timing and intensity of the number of deaths in Sweden and UK. And I think that strongly suggests what I just said is true, that lockdown has been for naught. So someone must have put pressure on Chris Whitty and Pat Vallance, because what they were speaking about originally in those emails was an entirely correct thing to do, as Gupta and Bhattacharya and Kordorff have later said, which is you should do your best to spare the most vulnerable. But other than that, you don't really have a choice. It's just a question of how you act as the virus sweeps through. And let me just say again, in case people think I'm brutal, the total death toll in England, in the UK, is 0.06%. Not 6% or 0.6%, 0.06%. Normally in a year, roughly 1%, a little under, roughly 1% of our population, I'm afraid, don't reach their next birthday. Mostly from old age, sometimes from other diseases like cancer. So we have crashed the country for 0.06, about 3 weeks worth of normal deaths. Now, Sweden also had 0.06% of their population die, and now they're living normally. Now, biology doesn't work like that. It's not possible. Biology is not political. Science on scale is not political. It's a natural phenomenon. In fact, what has happened to us is a natural phenomenon. Our response is unnatural. But the point is I'm making, their density as a country is slightly more urban. People think that maybe the Swedes live in little huts in the woods, which is fairly racist. But actually, they are as urbanized as we are, slightly more. And mostly the people who died tended to be 80, 82 and older, and they lost 0.06% just like us, and now it's stopped. So you could ask yourself, is that consistent with what's happening, claimed to be happening in my country, when this Eden guy points out that there have not been any excess deaths since the end of June, and there are not excess respiratory deaths now. So it's up to you. I mean, I don't even need to be a scientist at this point. Any lawyer, any skilled professional hearing these words would think something smells a rat. Well, it does, yes. Why it's happening, I've no idea, not my job, but it's definitely happening, and it's false.
Like I said, it must be draining for you to keep doing these interviews. Do you think you're getting anywhere and getting this message to people?
No, I am concerned. I'm not a media person. When I publish stuff, I went through the normal peer review process. I have 60 peer-reviewed original research journal articles under my belt. Not that that was ever particularly what I wanted to do. I was in new drug discovery. I like understanding disease and why it happens, how you can fix it, what has gone wrong at a molecular level, and to try and relieve symptoms or the ongoing disease. And really, all I've done is applied that same skill set, the sort of, a scientist knows for inconsistencies, things, basic things I know that clearly are not being, they're saying things that are happening that I just know are impossible. I should change all the rules of immunology. And so I looked around me, I could see no one in the media saying these things, medical correspondents, science experts, and so on. And so I'd no idea. My family used to say, well, we believe you, Dad, but why is no one else saying this? And then someone pinged me the Ofcom coronavirus broadcasting guidelines issued on the day of lockdown in March. And essentially it says that because idle speculation might be dangerous, people might not then do what the government says, we're going to ask you to comply with what the government says and their advisors, more or less, that's what it said. And it doesn't seem that unreasonable initially. It's just that the way I've heard it, because I've spoken to people in the media who won't interview me, that it's much stronger than that, that they're simply not permitted to put on air people with views like mine, even though I'm amply qualified to say this is an alternative view and I think you should look at it, that they will not interview me.
We've seen professors lining up, doctors lining up. We've seen press conferences. The scientific community, the medical community, I have seen, because obviously I've been following this story so closely. I mean, you must have seen the doctors in Germany, ACU 2020.
Yes, of course. And Belgium.
Absolutely. Yes. And I share it. And they go, you can't share this on Facebook and Google. Exactly. This is frightening.
Yes, exactly. Really. Same with Twitter. I have put factual things on Twitter that are not only within the law, they're what you would expect people to do in a free liberal democracy, which is to say, I don't agree with what the government's doing. It's all they're saying. And here's some reasons why you might want to consider something else. These tweets get deleted. That's not appropriate. And so you ask me, am I breaking through? I don't think so. The government knows about me. That's rather flattering. But I'm not a threat to them, even though I do think I understand what is happening. I don't know why, but I do think I understand what is happening and how it's being done. But then I'm not a threat to them because I'm not a publicly known figure. And even if I was, I don't have a platform. So what they will do, I think, is benign neglect. They will just ignore me and say they don't need to answer any charges I make.
You've not been, they can't smear you. See, this is what's really interesting. So I've had a senior dialysis nurse facing disciplinary action, okay, for talking on my channel. But then I've had Dr. Renny Hunderkamp. Has been on it. She's the resident London GP. Sorry, from BBC Radio London. She's the resident GP. I've had GP Rick O'Shea on my channel, no problems. But this senior dialysis, she's not allowed to speak. She's been threatened. They try and smear you. But if you have a reputation that can't be smeared, I don't. I had no problems whatsoever when I was at the BBC and ITV. Yes. I had a very successful company doing corporate training for big corporates all over the country. Mm-hmm. You have got a fantastic reputation. No issues in the past. So they can't smear you. What are they going to do? Just keep ignoring us?
That's what they're doing. So, for example, I was copied in to an exchange between a concerned constituent, and Mr. Jeremy Hunt, who is the former health secretary. And it was a three-paragraph reply where this woman had said, "Why you should be paying attention to Dr. Eden's assessment of what's going on." And he said, "We're well aware of Dr. Eden. It's not a question of suppression," he says. "It's simply that the scientific consensus does not agree with him." Really? So, and then he went on to say that it's not even clear that having been infected with COVID-19 leaves you immune. This is very uncertain. And given that, blah, blah, blah. I said, "You're kidding." Now, let me just tell you straight. When you are infected by a respiratory virus, it might give you symptoms, might make you ill. And if you're very vulnerable and old, it could kill you like flu. But when you survive, and 99.94% of the country survived the pandemic sweeping through, I assure you, you are immune. It's like immunology first lesson, first term first lesson. And we even know how that happens, and you can go back into people and determine that it's true. So, if it wasn't true, how did the virus leave your body? I mean, did it just give up halfway? This is the point. Unless you win the battle, it's trying to multiply in your tissues. That's what it does, and you are trying to stop it. And if there's a severe battle, you can get ill. Sometimes you lose and die, but most of the time that battle is won by your immune system. It's not the force of will. It doesn't give up, so you have to have beaten it, and the way you did it was with your immune system. Right? It's just,
but we don't agree with you. You're wrong. The politicians and the media are saying you're wrong.
I know, I understand. But what I would say is open any immunology textbook about virus infection, but specifically respiratory virus infection, and you'll find a table and it'll say it'll be the steps leading through respiratory virus infection to immunity. That's the title of the table. It doesn't say the steps that might leave you immune if a politician says you are. That's what happens. The only way it doesn't, because people will think that's funny, he's saying things I know that are not true. You don't get immune to HIV. HIV is not a respiratory virus, but the most important thing in relation to this conversation about it is it disarms your immune system, which is why you don't become immune. It's a toxin in that sense. SARS-CoV-2 and these viruses, they don't do that. They're fairly ordinary. The other way you might end up, as it were, still susceptible to something that sounds similar is like flu, where what they call the basically it changes its clothes every year. So you don't recognize it as something you've seen before. And it genuinely makes you ill. You're not immune to it. But things that are stable, like lots of viruses, like the coronaviruses, there are at least seven in common, well, at least four in common circulation, three others known. They're stable genetically. They don't mutate quickly. And so once you've had it, your body marks its card. And if it tries to approach you again, you might briefly get infected, you won't get symptoms, you are functionally immune. There's just no question. That's like...
Well, let's remind the audience, you were the chief scientific officer and vice president for Global Pfizer Global R&D. And you said that's the equivalent of the chief scientific officer for the government. And that's that company is, you know, what is Pfizer?
It's a huge multinational research-based pharmaceutical company that sells everything from over-the-counter medicines to the most important breakthrough anti-cancer medicines. So I haven't worked there for 9 years, so I'm not speaking for them. I'm an independent now. But yeah, they're a well-known, venerable R&D-based drug company. And so when I worked there, I was the most senior research person for respiratory inside the whole company. So I was the equivalent, I was the equivalent for Pfizer's respiratory for what Sir Patrick Rallance is for the country. I would provide advice and guidance in respiratory.
So following this interview, people could continue to close their eyes, shut their ears and not listen to what you're saying, okay? Or they can, maybe they can go to protests. They can join community groups. They can write to journalists. They can write to politicians. They could do something, couldn't they? What do you recommend people do if they listen to you and they agree with you and they want to do something about it?
So I would say, great question. There will be lots of people, I hope, who will hear this, who belong to professional bodies that will have a, they will have a, as it were, a board behind them, like the Royal Society, something like that, the BMA, British Pharmacological Society, of which I'm a member, was a member. There will be, so are there lots of learned societies, professional groups, probably dozens of them. And you don't need to be an epidemiologist or an immunologist, but you need to have, you need to take a view that since there's not excess mortality, since the PCR testing in the summer was proven to have false positives that probably accounted for most of the cases. Do you remember that exchange between Julia Hartley Brewer and Matthew Hancock? Well, I was kind of behind that because I could smell around then. So once you accept that the PCR test has a false positive rate, I think people should demand to know what that number is. You're not being told. If it's a few percent, that accounts for all the positives you're seeing now, end of pandemic. Remember that I've told you that there are no excess deaths. It's the thing that's pathology that's stalking land right now is the government's PCR testing system. Testing the well population, people aren't ill. It's just a madcap thing because almost all of them don't have the virus. But if you run it hard, run this machine hard enough, you will end up with an enormous number of false
positives.
We've
gone back to facts again. We've gone back to facts.
What should they do? What should they do? Yes, I think, so if you're a member of a professional society, learned society, have a look at the facts. And if you don't believe that taking further measures right now, while the mortality is absolutely normal for the time of the year, I think you should write an open letter to the government saying, I believe SAGE is incorrect in its advice. And you should immediately disband it and begin to speak to independent people. That's the thing I think they should do. In practical terms, I do believe that if the PCR mass testing were to stop, within 3 weeks, the country would be normal.
Okay, that's really important.
There is no disease, and if you stop testing, everything will be normal. Now, it wouldn't let the virus get out of control. You keep using it for hospital admissions, but just stop testing the masked well people. That's what you should do.
There's something really important I do need to speak to you about as well. And that's, and you may not feel that you can give any response whatsoever, but you know, this talk of vaccination and people in the health system and education, you know, we don't know at the moment when the vaccine is going to be available. But there's a lot of fear that it might become mandatory. What's your view on vaccination to help people? And I've said that I want to make sure we provide some informed debate on this quite serious issue.
Yes, certainly. So because I'm ex-big pharma, as they say, and then I worked in biotechnology companies, so, you know, I'm not exactly some fluffy person who's going to tell you never to take a vaccine, they're all bad. I've had all the vaccines available in the 1960s and 70s. Both my children, my wife and I decided they should get the full lot. I'm pro well-characterized vaccines. That absolutely prevents a tremendous amount of illness and death. But in the case of something like SARS-CoV-2, that kills one in 500 people or so, average age 83, I think it'd be great if we had a vaccine for people like that. It might give them a few more months of life, not much more. The reason you die having caught it is not because you've got SARS-CoV-2, it's because you've got a respiratory virus. Almost any of them will kill you at that age. Even a serious cold will kill you. So it would be good, I think, to have a vaccine to use for very vulnerable people. But, this is a really important but, nobody else needs this thing. Your body and my body, I'm not vulnerable. I'm not going to be made seriously ill and die. It would be an astonishing thing, one in a million. You don't vaccinate the population because one in a million people might have a bad outcome. What you do is you look at the people who are vulnerable and you offer them the vaccine with the word offer. Informed consent is important. So it's not necessary. And it's an appalling misuse of a public platform for people to suggest that the only way we all get our lives back is if we mass vaccinate the population. Something very smelly is going on. It's simply not appropriate. It's never been required to do that. I don't even think it would work. But let me also just mention, because I'm was in the pharmaceutical industry, I am capable of reading development plans. So I've been on a site called clinicaltrials.com, and you can go and look up what's going on with the vaccines. I will say to you that so far, normal for the stage of development, they're looking at antibodies. They're looking at whether the vaccine raises antibodies. That's all they know. They don't know whether it reduces how ill you get or whether you transmit the virus, nor does it measure whether you will have reduced deaths. We don't know this now. This is 3 years too early, 2 or 3 years too early. So all we're going to know when we start vaccinating people is it raises antibodies. And I'm telling you that whilst antibodies are a good thing to have, and I would like to have them if I was very ill, they are not the most important part of your immune system. It'll almost certainly be T cells. So I think there's a vaccine development plan that's going to lead to only a small amount of information about it. And then, as I said earlier, you don't need it. You know, if you're young, middle-aged, even slightly my age, 60, and well, you're really not very vulnerable. So I would say if you would not have considered a flu vaccine in the normal course of events coming up to this winter, I don't think you should even consider taking this vaccine. But the main problem I have with it, as you mentioned, is this notion of being mandated or even coerced. So you don't have to, but you can't travel if you don't. That's the sort of thing. I want your viewers to know that that's illegal under international law. That after the Second World War atrocities of Dr. Mengele and other doctors in Japan, where they performed experiments on humans that led to their deaths, we and others in the post-war consensus led to an international law that says that no medical procedure may be performed on a human being without their informed consent, and they must benefit from it, and about 10 other things, but that's basically at the heart of it. Your government doesn't have the right to override that law. So if people are saying you've got to, otherwise you can't go shopping, or you can't go to work or travel, take them to court. It's absolutely illegal, and no one should stand for it. But to say again, I'm pro well-characterized vaccines. If you're elderly, frightened, and vulnerable, and it's available, I would say work with your doctor, consider it. Maybe you should. But everybody else, you don't need it, and something very odd is going on. I don't know what
it is going on, and anxiety doesn't help the immune system, does it? So, you know, my son's in year seven, and one person got tested positive, and the whole school sent home for 2 weeks. And then he goes back to school, and he may come back. And that's not where I want my child to be living life like that going on.
Why are they doing that?
Well, this is what worries me. So if they're doing that, what's the end game? And people keep saying, what's the end game? Which is why I'm worried that mandatory vaccination might come in. But we don't know, do we?
I have no idea. So people often ask me, in fact, it almost seems to be a condition for accepting anything I have to say. Well, why would they do that? And I honestly answer, I don't know. You know, I'm not a detective or a politician, but that shouldn't take away from whether I'm right or not. So back to the facts, there are not excess deaths right now. But that's not what the BBC tells you every night. I am never going to trust them again, by the way. I listened to the BBC for 41 years, never coming back in my ears because they've just lied in my face all year. So there are not excess deaths. There are not excess respiratory deaths right now. The slight uptick of a few hundred non-respiratory deaths that have been reported recently, I think, are the consequence of restricted access to the NHS So I don't want anyone flinging that at me saying, oh, you're wrong about access deaths. Those deaths are just what you'd expect if you restrict access to the health system to a population for 6 months. And what do you expect was going to happen?
I can clearly sense, you know, and I know I give this vibe off as well, because I care about people, and I know how the media works. So I know that you need communication strategies and lots of money to control the narrative. Money controls the narrative. So if you're, sure, you know, a suicide charity, or if you're a care home, you don't get that message out on the old media, I call it. And like you say, you've completely lost trust to the BBC. I would just like to finish the interview by saying thank you for sharing your so bravely. You know, you've got nothing to gain from this whatsoever, and neither have I. No. I want to go back to what I was doing before. I was in a good money. It was easy. This is stressful. It's upsetting.
I want to spend time with my wife. I want to hug my children. And we've got one grandchild, Freddie, and we love him, and we want to be able to pick him up. We're not supposed to, so we're kind of not going to. I don't agree with the laws are completely mad, but I'm a guy, I comply with laws. I then argue against them. But at the moment, I'm even told if I do that, then I'm somehow dangerous. But anyway, yeah, I want to go back to normal, and I'm very worried about what's coming, and that's why I've got involved. I have nothing to gain. I'm you know, nothing at all. I'm not political, never been a member of any campaigning group until now, but I feel the need to say something, because what's happening is there's a fraud going on.
There is a fraud going on, and it's very difficult for anyone to speculate. And I have mentioned, you know, there is talk of things like there's something going on behind the scenes, and these global organizations are getting together, and they're pumping money into the countries and making us more dependent upon the maybe a global and undemocratic forces forming in terms of a great reset. But I don't really know. I'm trying to get interviews with these people so we can understand what's going on.
I don't know either.
We need trust. We need debate to build trust. To build trust in the government, we must have debate in the media. We must allow these fears and concerns and facts to be talked about in a calm and rational way. But you don't want to speculate either, I should imagine.
No, I don't. When people do ask me this, I say, I think everything was normal up to, possibly that witty balance exchange that you talked about. And certainly, I would say that the pandemic itself passing through the country was absolutely real. You know, people got sick, lots of people rushed to hospital, and they did die, 45,000 or so. And something happened in the summer. And it was when they started mass testing the population. That's when I became deeply suspicious. That's when I started looking at the assay itself. I've used tests like this, so it's not difficult for me to look at it. And I thought, that's funny. They're not telling us what the false positive rate is. And I went through government documents and I found an internal document that more or less said, don't use this test because we don't know the characteristics. So something happened around June, maybe earlier.
Something happened then, and now you're in lockdown. You're in France. We never thought we'd be in lockdown again. No. How did that happen? We're in lockdown.
Well, of course, this is the bit that's very, very important. I don't know. It could be that the lockdown this spring was done. Maybe there was political pressure. The media certainly pressured the government into doing something. Personally, I knew at the time that it's not going to make any difference, because people don't pass the virus to each other as they pass in the streets or chatting to your neighbour. So the locking down bit, I could tell what it would do is stop the economy and inhibit civil society. But I knew it would do nothing to transmission. Because mostly transmission happens where ill people meet other vulnerable people, hospitals, care homes. Sorry, that's true. And that's why the profiles are the same in countries that did and didn't lock down. But I almost wonder, did they make us lock down because it has conditioned us? See, now we're ready. We're ready to go and lock down again. I've just told you there are no excess deaths. There haven't been for 4 months. What are you doing? You're walking into voluntary house arrest when there is not an excess death signal. Why are you doing that? Seriously, question. Ask yourself, why are you going to be willing to be locked down, quote, to get away from a virus, which I'm telling you is not present, because if it was, you'd have lots of excess deaths. That's why I'm very fearful, because it doesn't make any sense. And I think there are no benign outcomes. I'm not going to speculate. There are no benign outcomes from this.
It doesn't make any sense. I'm aware of three groups. One of them is called Us for Them. which is campaigning for children's rights, another one called Keep Britain Free, another one called Save Our Rights UK. These are campaign groups that I'm aware of that are growing up, getting very much more organised.
There's lots and lots of groups. One has been launched today. There's one, I think it's called Recovery UK. Recovery UK, reported in the paper today. So I've said I'll join that as a scientist. I'm not a politician, but I will. If they want someone to speak on science, I will do that.
And I'm not a campaigner or a protester either. And people contact me. These organisations are growing. They're getting more organised. Yeah. You know, there's lots of them as well in little groups in Stroud, for example, and Dundee, all around the country on Facebook.
Great.
And it's about them getting together, I think, and working out how they want to approach the situation if they feel it doesn't make any sense, which is what you've kind of a lot
That's
of people
right.
feeling at the moment. So is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish the interview? And thank you again for doing this.
No, only just to repeat again, for those who come in right at the end, you can say what my qualifications were. So there are at present no excess deaths in the UK. I believe the pandemic ended at the end of summer, and I think the government has simply pretended that it's not happened by continuing to use on ever-increasing scale a test that is error-prone. And I think all of the things that you're seeing occurring to your great country are secondary to that decision. And consequently, if you can persuade the government just to pause that test for 3 weeks just to see if I'm right, you'll recover your country. And if you don't do that, I don't know what's going to happen, but it's not an accident and it's not benign. That's it.
Thank you so much. Well, I tell you something, Dr. Mike Yeadon, you have performed a responsibility and your duty to your fellow man by sharing this information. I have by being a journalist and giving you a platform.
Thank you, Anna.
Let's leave it to the public to decide what they want to do from this point onwards, I think.
Yes.
I think we've done what we can and we're doing what
we can. Yeah, go and look at the data and see whether what I've said is true, because if it's true, then you must assume that the things you're being told by your government and your media that you've trusted for decades are not true. So it's up to you.
It's up to you guys watching this. Thank you so much. You take care and keep
Thank
in
you
touch.
Anyway.
You're back on the channel any time, as obviously things are changing. You take care speak to you soon. Bye.
Will do.
And you had been listening to Anna Brees, presenter Anna Brees, former BBC presenter, interviewing Dr. Michael Yeadon. They're both from the UK originally, I believe. And now we're going to turn to another British presenter, and that's Emma Kenny. And she's been working for children's charities and on behalf of mental health in Britain. And I believe what she says here applies equally to all of us in the United States. And I think you'll find it a powerful presentation.
The reason that I entered the therapeutic field was for one single reason. I believed in hope. Hope has always been beneath every therapeutic action that I've taken. It forms the foundation of my thoughts. It's why I stand before you here today. And for the first time in my life, as a therapist, as a mother, as a daughter, as a sister and a friend, I feel my hope is being challenged on every level. I am witnessing a sustained and a powerful attack on the mental well-being of every single human in the UK. An attack that is being branded as protection. Human beings are animals. We require human contact, close connection, and social bonds, not simply to thrive, but to survive. Research is telling us a terrifying story, and one that will be told for many, many years to come. One whose ending will be decided based on moments like today. The damage is being furthered with every passing second. The time bomb is ticking, growing more powerful, more grotesque, with outcomes far bigger and far wider than most of you listening will have even dared to imagine. And if we allow restrictions to continue this way, the death, damage, and destruction will only grow. I and so many of my peers believe fiercely that children, more than any other demographic, require safeguarding. Legally and morally, our democratic society should wish to protect children from harm. In fact, the Children's Act clearly and rightly states that children's welfare should be the paramount concern. and that physical, emotional, social, and educational harm is unacceptable on any level where children are concerned. Safeguarding measures exist so that the health, well-being, and human rights of individuals, especially children, young people, and the vulnerable, are protected, so that they can live a life free from harm, abuse, and neglect. Yet harm, abuse, and neglect is exactly what the current restrictions are causing. The last 7 months has seen an exponential rise in reported levels of stress, anxiety, and depression, with research finding that 80% of young people are experiencing a decline in their mental health. Suicidal thoughts in young people are also sharply rising. These are children, and they are so afraid, so traumatized, so concerned about their future, that they are deciding whether to experience a future at all. Self-harm has increased. It is now believed that 1 in 6 of our children meet the criteria for a mental health problem. What are we doing? How can we fail our future so dreadfully, and failing we are? The messages pumped into our population to terrify so many of us into submission have been reprehensible, unnecessary, and so traumatizing that children's charities are now dealing with COVID PTSD. And even more depressing is that most of these children will fail to receive any help whatsoever, because mental health services couldn't cope before this pandemic, before we crippled a whole generation who deserved so much more. The government and the media have taught children to be afraid of living, of playing, of loving. They've even gone as far as telling our impressionable youth that they have the power to kill granny. Imagine what that has done to children who have lost loved ones during this pandemic, even if that was through other conditions. Yet this type of unacceptable conditioning has been allowed to trample all over developing brains of children and young people. One of the biggest killers in the UK is poverty. In fact, poor people die on average 10 years younger than their affluent peers. And yet, who are restrictions affecting most? The poor. And children in poverty are 2.5 times more likely to die before they even reach adulthood than those who are affluent. This was what research told us before the coronavirus, before the poverty gap grew wider and bigger than ever before. Children and young people are having their security ripped apart on every level. Their education, which for some children is the only consistent safety and care that they experience, has been utterly desecrated and thrown into chaos. Many children who are struggling with their academic journey have had an irreparable hole blown into their learning. They have had their futures stolen through this unforgivable state neglect. They are watching their parents lose jobs. They will soon watch them lose their homes, because restrictions are killing the economy, ruining businesses, and devastating the employment landscape, meaning that many adults will struggle to find work again. I look at opinion polls and I see the government reacting to a small percentage of the population whose interests are less to do with we and all to do with me. They are not affected by restrictions. They do not feel the pang of hunger or the threat of abuse, so they can enjoy their sunrise and sunset without noticing the agony that lies in less privileged places as restrictions ruin lives. Did you know that 2 million homes in the UK have no access to the internet? And 30 million people rely on pay-as-you-go phones with limited data, meaning that the poorest and most marginalised have no voice. Imagine having no voice. This silence means that they cannot tell you their stories. And their story will unequivocally be to end restrictions so that they can feed their children and remain in the jobs and homes that they deserve to keep. What future are we creating for our children? The slogan Build Back Better may have a nice ring to it, thought up in some middle class PR meeting where no doubt those who came up with it imagined that the Twitterati would hashtag the hell out of it and suddenly all the devastation would just disappear. But in truth, there is no Build Back Better for most of us here in the UK. And for some, there will be no Build Back at all. And why are we even at this point? Because aside from week 17 of the pandemic, in mid-April, all-cause mortality rates this year are comparable to recent years. And 99% of coronavirus are mild. Yet we continue to destroy the lives and livelihoods of millions of people in the UK. How have we arrived here? And how is this being allowed to continue? Because if I am to draw any conclusions from this situation, it is that the coronavirus restrictions have been branded as being brought in to protect the vulnerable and have done the absolute opposite. In fact, I do see coronavirus as one of the biggest threats to humanity, but only because of the utterly inhumane restrictions that are killing many, many more than they ever came close to protecting. When I read the statistics on child suicide and it lists deaths between the ages of 10 and 19 years of age, 10. I know that society is fundamentally broken. And a society that continues to accept this is barbaric, hostile, and anti-democratic. If we continue to support restrictions, knowing the catastrophic collateral damage that is happening with every second that passes, at a cost to everything else, then we are knowingly and therefore willingly choosing to kill many other people by many other means, children included. Whether that be from suicide, cancer, heart disease, poverty, social isolation or dementia, to name just a few. We cannot turn away from the uncomfortable truth that the government is not only failing to protect us, but now actively choosing to harm us, to harm our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends. They are failing to protect our high streets, our entrepreneurs, our businesses, our futures. And whilst you may find it hard to look that reality in the eye because of what that reality may mean, now is not the time to turn away. Because without you, without all of you, my lone voice is just a whisper. But if you join me and if you stand with us at Recovery, then this whisper becomes a roar. Every generation witnesses a moment in time that has the power to change the world. And for us, that moment is now. Stand up for what is right. Protect our children. Free the elderly from their care home restrictions, allow families to thrive, breathe back life into business and give each and every human being in the UK their God-given right to autonomy, to freedom of choice, because that is democracy. And for all our sakes, it's time to demand it back. Thank you.
And that was Emma Kenny speaking. She's a former British news presenter and she now works for children's charities. You've been listening to Politics and Science. Before Emma Kenny, we heard Anna Breeze on Anna Breeze Media interviewing Dr. Michael Yaden, who's an allergy and respiratory disease therapeutic expert, works for Pfizer presently. And many thanks to Anna Breeze, Dr. Michael Yaden, and Emma Kenny for allowing me to rebroadcast their excellent material. That's going to do it for Politics and Science. I hope you found this interesting. And I urge you to please tune in again next week to another edition of Politics and Science.
Well, we're the birds in the trees. Know something we can't see. As they know, we were born to be free. Don't need the government cramping my style. Give them an inch. They take a mile, take you in with a phony smile. Wouldn't you agree? A new normal is not normal. It's no kind of normal at all. Everyone seemed to have amnesia, just trying to remember the Berlin Wall. Some kind of new old life. Theology, a weird new psychology, but it's not for the benefit of you and me. No, no, no.